Hey, I'm Eric Thornburg, and welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we explore what makes the makers, what drives them, what they're scared of, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's episode is with Brett Taylor. Brett previously was CTO of Facebook, built Google Maps, and is now founder of Quip. In this episode, we talk about what it was like working with Zuckerberg at Facebook and the rest of the team. We talk about what it was like working at Google, how he's grown as a CEO and founder of Quip, various lessons he's learned along the way, and much, much more. Brett has a ton of interesting nuggets in this episode, and I think you will enjoy it and learn from it. All right, here's Brett. Brett, welcome to Product Hunt Live.
Thanks for having me.
Perfect. So I have so much we're going to get into today, from past story to career philosophy to management philosophy. But first, I want to start off with you guys have a huge announcement at Quip. We've been, you know, lucky to be playing with it for a while now. But tell us, what is the big announcement at Quip, and tell us about it.
Yeah, that sounds great. So Quip is a unique product. It combines documents with chat, so you can essentially communicate and write in the same product. So you can work and make decisions without reverting back to email like most offices do, which is a really awesome thing in a world where I think most people kind of like get that Pavlovian sweaty response when they open their email inbox. Quip's kind of a breath of fresh air. You can actually, kind of feels like a whiteboard in an open office. That's really kind of the metaphor we use when designing it. So the new product is kind of recognizing that Quip documents are pretty different than traditional documents, in the sense that they're really long-lived, they have lots of authors, and they're constantly being updated. So we've made the centerpiece of Quip an inbox, which is unusual for a documents product, but it kind of recognizes that the communication part of Quip is as important as the writing part. And the word we're using to describe this experience is living document. You guys use Quip at Product Hunt, but just to put a number on what I mean by living document, Instacart, which is another tech startup in our area, over 60% of the documents they created a year ago are still being used today. They're being erased and rewritten. They're like checklists, not documents that are published, which I think is pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious, you've worked at Google, you were the CTO of Facebook. What made you want to start a company in the productivity space?
So one of the things I did at Facebook was run the mobile group. And I think mobile impacted Facebook almost at least faster than most other companies, just because it's so widespread. And there were entire regions of the world, like sub-Saharan Africa, where people had never even seen Facebook on their computer. Like 97% of people had only ever seen it on a phone. And when I left Facebook to start a company, one of the exercises my co-founder Kevin and I did was, in 10 years, what is going to be the product that will be really significantly impacted by this move to smartphones and tablets that might not be obvious now? And for us, it felt like the productivity suite, because it just felt like the idea that you're writing words on a virtual 8.5 by 11 piece of paper in a world where no one prints anymore and most people are using their phones to read just felt wrong. And the more we talked about it, even the idea of a file attachment felt really antiquated. When you get tagged in a photo on Facebook, you don't get an email about it. You just get a push notification. And we really felt like the world of productivity was stuck in the PC metaphors. And we really wanted to create an experience around messaging and notifications. It's kind of a social experience around this product suite that was first done by Apple with the introduction of MacWrite in 1984 and hadn't really changed since.
You didn't have to do this again.
Yeah, oh, that question. Yeah. honestly, being an entrepreneur is a little bit rational, a little bit irrational. So there's definitely a part of it, which is like people like me and like a lot of you at Product Hunt. I mean, it's more fun to be David than Goliath, And in particular, you get to do things as a startup you don't get to do as an incumbent. Like, we don't have the burden of, 30 years of the .doc file format holding us back in terms of product innovation. And it means that we can do things that are completely, our competitors can't do. And then similarly, I think that, we really had a strong opinion about the way productivity should work, being oriented around teams, being oriented around messaging. And I don't think it would be easy to go into a really large existing company with lots of customers and convince them to disrupt themselves and throw out their multi-billion dollar product suite to do something that we really felt should exist. And so it's a little bit irrational, a little bit rational.
So. And I want to get very detailed in the Quip, but first I want to go even back further. When you were in high school and college, did you foresee yourself, being at the biggest tech companies over the next decade? Did you know you were going to be an entrepreneur?
So I went into Stanford thinking I was going to be a history major and then a lawyer. And then this was in 99, 2000. So being at Stanford at the time, the dot-com bubble was happening and it was really infectious. And like the promise of new technology was really infectious. I had made money on the side doing web pages. So it wasn't like a complete huge transition for me to do that. And then I worked for a guy named John Lilly at a startup called Reactivity. And after working there for a summer, I knew that I wanted to be in technology for the rest of my career. Notably, John is my mentor to this day, went on to become CEO of Mozilla and is now one of our investors at Greylock. So it's just really interesting that that was my first boss, my first internship. For me, what's really awesome about Silicon Valley is the building culture. Like everywhere you go, you find someone who's building something, like making something new. It's almost like code speaks. You know, it's not just ideas. People are actually making and prototyping. And I think that's a pretty awesome mentality. I remember like this really pivotal moment. My dad is a mechanical engineer and builds buildings. And I remember thinking, do I want to do that for my, you know, my career? And I remember thinking like, even if I do that, by the time I'm like 30 or 35, I'll actually be senior enough or experienced enough to actually do what he does. With software, it's fascinating because the moment you learn how to program, you can do anything. I mean, there's really no barriers in your place from making something and delivering it to people. That's why it's so cool about things like Product Hunt. I mean, it's like providing a forum for these apps that would have otherwise not gotten distribution, but it's a really liberating and awesome profession. And I knew it kind of the moment I got my first internship.
In 2003, you started at Google. What was it like to be at Google in 2003?
So it was really funny. It's kind of clueless, actually. So I was an engineer for a company for a summer that I won't name. And I was really miserable. It was like a enterprise security software. And every day a product manager would come over to me and hand me this like stack of papers saying, you implement this. And there was like no creativity in the whole process. And I thought, wow, this is what engineering is like in Silicon Valley. I don't want to do it. I want to be like thinking about how to design products. So by chance, a woman named Debbie Jaffe emailed me and said, we're hiring product managers for Google. Do you want to interview? And it was funny, I had no idea what a product manager was, but I said yes anyway. I was just like, better than what I'm doing right now. And what's funny is I interviewed through the whole interview process. I don't think I quite knew what the job was. I mean, I knew basically, but like I'd never seen a product manager before. I didn't know what they did. And I accepted it kind of like sight unseen. And it ended up being a really like impactful decision of my life. But honestly, it was a little bit blind. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing, but I knew I wanted to do something different. Now, I was just going to say, like, once I got there, it was really crazy. So I shared my first office with the professor who wrote my AI textbook at Stanford, Peter Norvig. I mean, it's like you're surrounded by the best minds in computer science, people who wrote Unix or wrote the canonical textbook in artificial intelligence. And I don't know, it was really intimidating, I think is probably the right word. I mean, I'm the PM for a guy who months ago was a professor. And, you know, and I think that's it's sort of a comical experience. So I just spent like the first year or two just trying to be useful and then got some street cred because I'm kind of a geeky guy, even though I was a product manager. And then Marissa Meyer, who is my boss, who's now the CEO of Yahoo, told me I could work on Google Local, which was a new product initiative, which was kind of the first major new thing that I worked on there. A few iterations later, that turned into Google Maps, which was really cool, which is kind of my crowning achievement there. So it was a lot of just like getting coffee for these engineers for a while and then kind of like finally get an opportunity to build something new.
Did you think you might be there for a decade at one time, or did you know that you wanted to start your own thing?
You know, I always thought I would want to start a company, but I didn't know when. Google was a pretty awesome place to work. So I think it was really hard to choose to leave just because they really respect their employees. They give engineers a lot of autonomy and freedom. And, you know, I really had no concrete complaint. It was kind of a confluence of things, you know, like Google Maps had kind of, we had launched, I'd worked on it for a couple of years. It was maturing. And then my friend Jim Norris and I came up, it was interesting. It's hard to describe the culture of the company at the time, but Google didn't really have much user-generated content at all at the time. They were just indexing other people's stuff. And then on the side, I saw services like Wikipedia and Yelp start, you know, forming at the time. And I became really interested in not like just how to build software, but how to build social systems where, you know, there was an interplay between people, human beings, there's a thought, and the software that I was making. And that really wasn't a part of the Google product development culture. And it was a little bit like, I was talking about like, why did Quip have to be a startup? Well, I don't think I could have made a social network at Google at the time. You know, I don't think it was really something Google respected or cared about. And so we decided that that was really compelling to us and decided to leave primarily for that reason.
Selling to Facebook. Tell us about that story. What was that like?
Yeah, so Jim and I left Google and then ended up partnering with Paul Buchheit and Sanjeev Singh. Paul's now a partner at Y Combinator. They had all previously created Gmail. And we were really interested in the newsfeed. Facebook's newsfeed had sort of come out recently. And we were really interested in the idea of building social discovery for the rest of the web. You know, the idea that your friend sort of publishes a Flickr photo. Unless you're on Flickr, there's no way to know about it. So we're really interested in like, could we create a news feed for the entire internet? And that was kind of the vision for the product. I always joke with my friends, it's kind of like the Apple Newton of social networks, meaning it was a commercial failure, but we invented a lot of features that became widely used in other social networks, like the like button. So it was really fun. It was a 12-person startup. We were in a warehouse in the middle of Mountain View, and it was like, just an amazing startup experience. I mean, that group of people, a few of them work at Quip now, and it's like still this group of people that I consider some of my closest friends and colleagues to this day.
For you to go into Facebook and then become the CTO of Facebook, what was that experience?
Yeah, it was interesting. So when we sold the company to Facebook, my becoming CTO wasn't like a part of the package. We chose to sell the company because we were losing our battle to Twitter primarily. But then on top of that, we really felt aligned with the vision that like Facebook's vision for social networking was really the same as ours. So we knew that we could continue working on what we loved, even though we were selling the company, which was really, really important to us. And then, you know, when I got there later, like a few months in is when Mark, you know, made that role change for me. And it was pretty cool. I mean, one of the things I respect most about Mark Zuckerberg is that I was pretty young and pretty inexperienced still at that point in my career, perhaps still now. And I thought it was pretty cool that, you know, he respected my raw abilities and was willing to make kind of like a leap of faith there to put me in that role of a fair amount of responsibility, despite the fact that I was pretty young and pretty inexperienced. And that's something that I think is pretty unique about Mark as a manager and a leader is that he really respects like raw intelligence and raw ability and product vision over the kind of like resume of individual people at the company. And that's pretty unique, to be perfectly honest.
Or most other leaders don't do that?
You know, you'll hear a lot of these things from like, if you read about, you know, venture capitalists pressuring startups to bring in professional management, you know, that was when Google got funding, which was before my time, you know, there was sort of a expectation that they would bring on a professional CEO, in that case, Eric Schmidt, because these PhD computer scientists can't run a company. They're just the tech guys, you know? And I think that Mark, due to the advice he got and his just natural sort of boldness and willingness to do things differently, was willing to sort of buck those trends and not sort of just bring on the people who are like the typical people you bring on to bring in these roles. And I think the reason why I was really impressed by it is you can't imagine as like a, particularly for Mark, he dropped out of college, this is his first and only company, to be able to have the boldness to like ignore the traditional advice and do something new. I mean, that takes a lot of courage, to be perfectly honest. And I don't think most startups do it.
And it's interesting. Has that traditional advice sort of changed over the past decade? Is it now in vogue or, you know, to keep the founder or to sort of take those risks? Not
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a little bit of a cycle. I think like in the dot-com bubble, bringing on the professional managers was often like a prerequisite for funding, like at least from what I understand it was for Google. And then, you know, starting a little bit with Facebook and the terms that Mark, you know, was able to negotiate for Facebook, that had a trend where other entrepreneurs, when they were doing their rounds, the expectations had really transitioned to be a lot more founder-friendly. And I think in general, when, you know, money is cheap, founders have more leverage and when it's tighter times, investors have more leverage. But, you know, I think one thing that is true is that like it's really impossible to replace a product visionary at a company. I mean, you see the trials and tribulations of companies like Twitter bringing in, you know, after Jack left, you know, it's like, it's really hard to replace that kind of spiritual leader of a company, but it's not that hard to train someone without management experience how to be a manager. So I think in general too, it's pretty rational that like, there's a reason why this person took risks to start the company, and it's hard to replace that kind of leadership.
Why did you Twitter beat?
I don't think our product was as good. I mean, I say that, you know, having been humbled, it's a little bit easier in hindsight. I think that the thing that we both companies really were passionate about was the follower model rather than the friend model. The idea that, you know, there was the idea that you should be able to like follow people you're interested in, not just people that you know personally. And that was a really powerful concept. I think the products, you know, in retrospect, we had a little bit of a hybrid where we built a lot of features assuming most of your followers were your friends, even though that's not necessarily the case. And I think Twitter kind of embraced the fact that this was more of a broadcast mechanism than a social network in a traditional way. I think we kind of had one foot in and one foot out. And then similarly, I think they were, you know, much more effective at like reaching celebrities and marketing and things that, you know, we're a bunch of computer geeks from Google, you know, and saw everything in code. And I think that that was something that in retrospect was definitely like a blind spot for the team who started that company.
In the past, you know, 15 years, one time you could say it's luck. Twice, do you think you just have a nose for these things?
You know, I mean, I think one thing that I have always been interested in is like working on the biggest problems that I could think of, as opposed to working on the thing I thought I could just win at. So like, you know, we went into social networking even though MySpace and Facebook existed because we thought we had a compelling idea for how social networking should work. Similarly with Quip, it's like we're competing with Google and Microsoft, two of the most formidable companies in the tech industry. But we really feel strongly that like we have a better idea of how this should work. And I think because I've been interested in those kind of like big problems, it tends to be like some good companies tend to work on those big problems. And so I think that was sort of like, you know, I was very interested in search and information retrieval out of college. I was really interested in social networking, which is, you know, how Facebook ended up acquiring us. So I think working on the biggest problems that I could think of is probably correlated at the very least, and then a lot of luck on top of that. So,
you spent nearly 4 years at Facebook. Was it the same thing as it was with Google? You just all of a sudden had, you know, this idea? Because you could have, you know, Facebook was continuously growing and it's one of the most exciting companies today. You could have stayed.
So again, there's a mix of like rational and emotional in all of these decisions. I mean, I think with any big job change. So the first thing was that my Kevin Gibbs, who's my co-founder of Quip, he was at Google at the time, and we had remained friends since I left Google. And he had just had a baby, was on paternity leave, and we had always talked about starting a company together. And for him, it was a really good time in his life. You know, he'd already kind of unwound himself from Google, you know, because of his paternity leave, which definitely was a motivating timing because he's someone I respect immensely. And the opportunity to work with him, I felt like I might miss out on. You know, he wasn't going to necessarily wait for me forever. So that was probably one of the biggest things is the wanting to work with Kevin Gibbs. And then, you know, Facebook had gone public and had sort of entered a period of relative stability as a company. It was a really tumultuous IPO and process up to the IPO. And so I sort of felt like it wasn't disruptive to the company for me to leave at that time. And I think had it been more disruptive, or I had perceived it to be more disruptive, I probably wouldn't have done it, just because, you know, I had invested so much of my friendships and sweat and blood into that company. I wouldn't have left had I thought it would have been more disruptive than it was. And then the final reason is that I was super passionate about the impact of mobile on other industries. You know, I saw it from Facebook's point of view, and I really felt like I don't think there's been that many technology transitions as disruptive as the smartphone. I look at a few, like the move from the mainframe to the PC, and the move from the PC to the internet connected PC, and then the move to the smartphone. If you actually look at the numbers though, the smartphone is way, way more impactful. I mean, there are more phones in the world than there are people. And the number of people using the internet through their smartphone dwarfs the numbers of people who ever used a PC. And I think as a consequence, I think the opportunity to like start a business and like, you know, build products that embrace this new way of working It's greater than it has been in almost any other technology shift, in my opinion, in my lifetime anyway.
In between Google and FriendFeed, you were an EIR at Benchmark for a short time.
Yeah.
How did that come about? And did you need that to start FriendFeed?
Yeah, it was definitely one of the best accidental decisions I ever made. So I was leaving Google, and just by chance, I mentioned my first internship was John Lilly's company, Reactivity. That company was being acquired by Cisco almost at the exact same month that I was leaving Google. And in that dinner, Peter Fenton, who was on the board of Reactivity, my name had come up and he reached out to me. And just by chance, I was planning on leaving Google, so accepted the coffee or lunch request or whatever it was. And that ended up becoming an offer to become an entrepreneur in residence. At the time, you know, my background, I was an engineer and product manager. I was a product person exclusively. I was extremely intimidated by the prospect of negotiating a funding round and just the scaffolding of starting a company. I mean, I was afraid there would be terms I didn't even understand, you know? And I think there's a lot more on the internet now, like Y Combinator and stuff didn't exist at the time. And so for me, it was like my business school. You know, I get to sit in on product pitches, hear them talk about deals and deal terms. And by the time I got around to actually raising money, I felt so much more confident that I wasn't being an idiot. and then as it turns out, Peter Fenton's been one of my closest advisors ever since. He invested in FriendFeed and now is an investor in Quip as well.
Did you think at one point that you might want to be an investor?
I don't think I want to be an investor. You know, I've invested in a few companies on the side, but what gets me up in the morning is building things. And, you know, I love to like create things and show them to people. I love to cook. I like to program. I just like making stuff. And that's definitely what's getting me out of bed in the morning.
Take us back 2012 when you think about the sort of culture and management philosophy that you wanted to instill into the company.
Yeah. So one of my advisors at FriendFeed was a guy named Mike Cassidy, who had started a number of successful companies. And one of the pieces of advice he gave me as a startup founder hiring was that being decisive is really, really important. Because when you're an employee at a really large company, even if your company doesn't tell you this, they kind of view you as a cog in a machine. You know, you're just an engineer and you're in a spreadsheet somewhere, and that's kind of your value to that company. What you can do at a startup, though, is you can really be a part of a family, you know, and your contribution you can feel every day. Your first day on the job, you can push a change to the product and understand your impact. And he said you want to reflect that in the interview process. So, you know, one thing he said is like, once you know you want to hire someone, like go into that interview and bring them the offer right then. Don't like wait a week and discuss it forever. You know, like make sure you have them feel that sense of urgency and feel how uniquely valuable they are to you. So what Kevin and I did when we started Quip was we listed the five or so people that we thought were the best people we knew, and we asked them to come to lunch with us, and we had an offer there, and we never interviewed them or anything. We just went out to lunch and gave them the offer, and a decent number of those people said yes, some of them on the spot. And it was one of the best decisions we ever made, because I think, as I said, it kind of communicated to them, like, you're not an employee. You're like the person we want to work with. And we don't want to go through some elaborate process to figure that out. We just want you right now. And it was a really cool experience and really reflected to me. I thought that was really good advice that Mike gave me back in the day.
Google's culture and Facebook's culture. And how does that relate to, you know, the culture that you wanted?
You know, it's interesting. Being at both companies, one of the things that's most interesting to me is they were so different culturally. And I think that if I had to, like, this is a caricature. I mean, these cultures are a lot more nuanced in practice, as you probably expect. But Google, I think, was really defined by the fact that Larry and Sergey came from academia. So the offices were set up exactly like the CS building at Stanford. You know, there were four people to an office. And there were offices, and the coffee machine was outside the offices, just like it was at Stanford. And the way people did product development was similar, like their design doc process and everything was really oriented around you write up what you're going to do and have it reviewed prior to implementing. And, you know, I wouldn't call it formal. It was just really rooted in that heritage of being from academia. Similarly, Facebook, which, you know, again, a caricature, was sort of had that move fast and break things culture that's now gotten a lot of press, but was really unique at the time, was really came from the fact that this was started in a dorm room and started with people who were like working on and iterating ideas almost in real time with the community of users using it. And it played out in all these really long-term ways. Like, you know, even when I got there, people would check in code on their first day at Facebook, you know, which was really like that move fast culture was deeply ingrained, like even in 2009 when I arrived there. And similarly, the academic culture, you know, like when I got to Google, they were still primarily hiring PhD students preferably, you know. And what's compelling though is both those companies were so successful, you know. And so like despite the fact they had a really, really different perspective on how to build a company, they were extremely successful despite that. And what I took away from it is that what's really important is your company have a strong point of view on the world and a strong culture that resonates with employees and, you know, a strong perspective on like what your product is and like its relationship to your user base and your relationship to your brand. But it doesn't necessarily need to be like a carbon copy of another company. And in fact, that's more often than not a mistake. Like people trying to copy Google will never copy it successfully, but people who create like a great new culture often can do it successfully. And so that's sort of what I took away from it, which is to be really assertive about your identity and, you know, figure out what it is and make sure people understand it and what your company values, and then build around that rather than trying to mimic another successful company.
How do you want people to perceive Quip?
You know, really what we think about is building products for work that are actually nice to use. What I mean by that is kind of bringing the consumer product mentality to enterprise software. Enterprise software has been like, I've actually used enterprise software as a derogatory term most of the time, because the way enterprise software has traditionally worked is that it's sales driven, meaning a salesperson meets with the head of IT and gives them a list of features or cost savings or whatever it is, and that IT manager decides to purchase the software. And the way you as an end user find out about it is you get an email from your IT department saying, here's how you do expense reports now. Like, whether or not you like it, sorry, this is the new way we do it. And there's really no real-time feedback loop between the end user and the people who make the software. And I think the reason there's so much more innovation in the product experiences of consumer software is because of that real-time feedback loop. The fact that, you know, most consumer products are free and ad supported means that they're really widely distributed and there's a really strong incentive to make it easy to use and really friendly to use. And we really want to bring the idea that your software at work should feel like social and lightweight and not need an instruction manual. We kind of think that's the way work software should work. And in 10 years, if we have a legacy, I want it to be that kind of like a little bit like what the iPhone did relative to the BlackBerry. You know, it's like, you can't remember the world before it because it's so much simpler now than it was.
Right. And you guys, and in the past couple of years, also Slack have really sort of changed the concept of what work tools can be. And I think it's interesting, you know, because you were now tech is obviously the zeitgeist and cool and, you know, mainstream, but you've been doing this for a long time. I mean, and even just, you're comparing Google and Facebook for a second. You were at Facebook when The Social Network came out.
That's right.
And so, and Mark Zuckerberg became this sort of icon of a generation in some in that movie, sort of, and Facebook too. Whereas Google, Larry, and Sergey, they're still, you know, most people don't even know who they are. You know,
yeah.
They come first on the street. How have you sort of perceived that change in terms of how people view technology and Silicon Valley and, you know?
So, I mean, I think what's great about the iPhone, Facebook, that movie, code.org, like things like this, I think we're getting much broader mainstream awareness that technology isn't, you know, a sweaty white guy, you know, over a keyboard in the dark. It's something that's mainstream. It's something about creating things. It's something that anyone can do, whatever your gender is, your race is, your background is, wherever you're in the world, technology enables you to make things. And I think that what I really have seen from this like mainstream awareness of technology is, I hope, just like broader interest in the category. And it's something like, you know, it's interesting. That's why I love things like Product Hunt, because I look at that homepage and I just see like every single idea in the world, there's someone making an app for that. There's someone building a tool to make that a better experience. And I look at, you know, things like Pixar and like the awareness of technology and the arts. And I see what I really hope the impact of all these things are is broad mainstream awareness. I mean, certainly it was surreal to be at that company when that movie came out and not altogether positive, to be honest. I mean, it wasn't a hugely positive reflection on the company. But, you know, you take with the perspective of hindsight, like it actually just raised the awareness of like that this college student changed the world. And actually that's what a lot of people took away from that movie, despite its incredibly negative connotation of the details. And I thought that was really interesting reflection on just kind of the cultural shift of awareness of technology.
You know, one thing I've noticed just from our companies being friends is that you guys, a lot of people at Quip have families. How do you, in you know, contrast to, you know, most people in Product Hunt do not. So I'm just curious as to how you've thought about that in terms of your team culture. And
yeah, so we actually thought a lot about this selfishly. I have three kids, my co-founder has two. And as I mentioned, you know, we started Quip while my co-founder was on paternity leave. So literally Quip was designed with a newborn in Kevin's hands. And I think hopefully she inspired a lot of great ideas. And you know, one of the things, the hardest part about working in Silicon Valley with a family is that there's a lot of implicit signals telling you that it's not going to work. So it's like the meeting scheduled for 6:30 p.m. You know, it's the all-night hackathon that, you know, there's a lot of peer pressure to go to, even if you might have an event with your kid that evening. And all those signals mean if you want to be the person with the work-life balance, you have to be in that awkward position of saying, hey guys, I can't come to the 6:30 p.m. meeting because I want to pick up my kid from school. And that's really uncool. You know, it's like, even though you have every right to do that, and it's honestly the right thing to do, it puts you in these really awkward social situations. So when Kevin and I were making a company, one of our goals was we wanted it to be a place that you could have work-life balance, you could have a family, you could feel like it was a marathon and not a race, and that if people stayed here for a decade, which we hope they do, they'll look back and feel like it wasn't sacrificing their personal life to be here. And what that means is just getting all the details right. You know, so my co-founder and I leave at 5:30 every day. Even if I have work to do, I'll do it at home because I don't want to send the signal to everyone else that you're supposed to stay longer than that. It's making sure that like meeting schedules adapt to people's family balance. It's just like talking about our kids and like making it a part of the company culture. And you know, it's not like everyone at Quip has kids, but it's just like sending the signal to everyone who does that like we care about this and you shouldn't have to sacrifice one to change the world.
How do you think about maintaining sort of a sense of urgency at the same time?
You know, I think it's a myth that the number of hours you put in are like correlated in your impact on the world, especially as a startup. I think the hardest thing is deciding to work on the right things, not writing as much code as quickly as possible. And if there's any legacy I hope we have is that we change the world and prove through our own action that that's the case. And I don't think, you know, right now, you know, our numbers have changed. When we launched the Quip desktop app earlier this summer, we were maintaining 8 different platforms natively with about, you know, 12 to 15 engineers, which is really unprecedented in our industry. And we were doing that with this work-life balance. So it hasn't kept us from being productive. And I don't think if companies make the right decisions, I don't think it'll keep them from being productive either.
Ruthless prioritizing of what's important.
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to any startup founder who's failed, as I, you know, FriendFeed was a failure by some definition of it, certainly didn't endure as an independent company. It wasn't because we didn't like write enough code. We just made the wrong decisions. And I think that's true of any technology product.
What are sort of principles you've said, okay, we're just not doing this?
Yeah, that's a really good question. In general, I think you want to get product feedback from your customers and kind of orient everything around that. And, you know, customers might be broad, you know, if it's a consumer product, your customers might not be paying you, but the people actually using your product. And I think as an early stage product, anything other than that is often a distraction. It's in part because it's almost like catnip. I mean, it's like, oh, that partnership deal will get us a bunch of distribution, or like, oh, let's, you know, get the promotion from Apple in the App Store or whatever it is. And more often than not, it's not as significant as you think it will be. The amount of time you put in is more than you think it will be. And it's extremely short-lived. I mean, in that time that you weren't actually responding to your customers' feedback, you're working on this like, you know, one-time kind of like a boost in installs or users or whatever it is, your product hasn't gotten any better. And so as a rule of thumb, until you have product market fit by some qualitative definition of that word, that's all you should be working on, in my opinion.
Did your experience in consumer sort of make you think, hey, I actually want to build something in the enterprise space? You know, I sell directly. It's a lot easier, you know, not easier, but sort of more.
No, I know. Yeah, it's fascinating. I always joke, like, this is the first time anyone's ever paid me for the software I've written. Yeah. Pretty unique experience. You know, it's interesting. So like, it wasn't like I went out saying I wanted to do enterprise software. What I really wanted to do was define like the next generation productivity experience. Like, as I said, I just couldn't imagine that Microsoft Office and email attachments was going to be the state of the art in a decade. And that was what was motivating it. And it turns out that the right way to build a business like ours is to sell it to the companies who want to be more productive. And that is the right business model. I don't think, you know, ad supported or freemium or all those would actually work for the product we're building. So I think the business model came from the product more than anything else. But it has been interesting because it's been a little bit of an asset for us. Because as I said, like, if we talk to like our customers, you know, like you guys, it's like, it does feel more like a consumer product than an enterprise product when you're using it. And that's our brand. And that's a huge asset for us because, you know, when you're competing against, you know, like SharePoint or something, which has every feature under the sun, but is a total piece of, you know what, when actually using it, that's a great brand to have. So I do think that our consumer background kind of like permeates everything that we do. But it wasn't like the only reason why we chose to go into this business model.
Right. And so also take me back to that time, you know, you sat down some of the most impressive people that you knew, you handed them offers, a bunch of them said yes, right on the spot. How did you think about company building from then on? Did you think we're going to keep it really small until we have a you know, product that people like?
Yeah, that's a really great question as well. So we did think about keeping the engineering team small. Engineering teams are interesting because when you have a small enough group of engineers working together, everyone knows everything going on. They can follow the check-ins, they can see what everyone else is doing, and you don't actually need to talk about it. You can actually just sort of passively observe it. And people can kind of keep the code base and the product complexity in their head. Once you pass kind of this, you know, Dunbar number, if you will, of engineers, you need this new layer of process and communication scaffolding to actually move forward. So in the part of product development at the beginning where you're iterating really quickly, you generally want as few engineers as possible, but no fewer. You know, so figure out like the minimum viable set of people. And you know, what our approach was is to pick some exceptionally productive and great people for our early set of, you know, folks. And it's not just like they're objectively great, but they're also like, we've worked with them before. There's a social dynamic already in place. It meant that we could, you know, remove a lot of the inefficiencies of just, you know, like what it meant to work together, you know, how to write code together and all those like really nuanced details of like that make a team productive or not. And now, you know, like we've grown from 22 to 37 people this past year, and we're growing pretty rapidly now. And I think we're kind of entering a new stage of product development just because, you know, as our customer base has grown over the past year, we tripled our ARR and 5x'd our customer base. Like, we just have a lot of complexity now. And so now we're sort of making the conscious decision to like, we want to do more, and we're willing to take on some of that, the complexity implicit in that.
It makes sense. And for entrepreneurs who find themselves in a similar position to Fortune where they can, they have a lot of investor interest, how do you sort of advise how entrepreneurs should think about their board, you know, what they should look for in board members and how to sort of evaluate?
I actually agree with most of the VC advice on this, which is prioritize the partner and the firm over other things like the valuation. Because at the end of the day, it's a slightly oversimplifying, but your company's either going to be worth a lot or not. Either you're going to create an independent company that impacts the world in extremely dramatic ways, and your value of your company will reflect that, or not. And there's going to be some other, you know, more modest exit that reflects that. And I think having the best partner in that, who really like is willing to give you the hard feedback, where there's deep trust, where they're going to, you know, provide perspectives that you don't have necessarily on your management team, is way more valuable than, you know, reducing dilution by a certain percentage or, you know, increasing the amount of money you raise by a nominal amount. And so that's the advice I give, is really focus on the relationships and those partnerships.
Kosla Ventures, I think they tweeted, or maybe it was someone there who tweeted, that 70% of firms actually offer negative value. Is that is that close to the case? Is that exaggeration?
Yeah, I mean, that's probably true. It hasn't been true in my experience, but I've had the good fortune of not having worked with like that many different firms. Benchmark was the firm I worked with my previous company, and then Greylock, which is the other firm invested in Quip. I know the people there fairly well. David Z was a board observer at Facebook. John Lilly was my first boss. Reid Hoffman is a friend of mine. So really, I've had the good fortune of partnering with investors who I know really well and who understand me, and I believe I understand them as well. There's just a lot of money in Silicon Valley. So it has that kind of gold rush mentality, for better and for worse. It means that there's tons of opportunity here, which is amazing. It also means that there's a lot of people just in it for the money. And I think that's what you should seek out when you're talking to an investor. Like, do they love technology? Do they believe in your product vision? Or are they looking, you know, just at the financial returns? Because at the end of the day, for early stage investing anyway, you have to believe in the product vision, because there's not like, you make a spreadsheet of your projected business and it's all made up. I mean, you know, it's like you're really talking about disruption and changing an industry, and predicting it is really takes kind of a leap of faith in that shared vision.
Knowing what you know now, nearly 4 years, you know, into running Quip, if you knew what you knew now in 2012, when you were just starting, is there anything that you would have done a bit different?
You know, 1,000 little product things. Like, I know everything that was wrong about our product then. I always joke with our designer, Matt Cahill. Every time we use a new design of Quip, we can't even look at the old design. We're like, oh, how did we even ever like that? And it's a good sign. I think every product designer feels that way when they're using their new design. But on the other hand, I wouldn't change what we're working on. I mean, the cool thing is, like, when we were first doing Quip, I think we talked to people, and the reaction from a lot of people is like, you know, email works for me. Like, attachments work for me. Office works for me. I don't really want to change. And now there's this broad interest in new productivity tools. You mentioned tools like Slack and Us, Trello. Like, people are moving away from Outlook and Exchange and Office and Gmail towards new and interesting ways of collaborating and communicating. And I think it's a lot more widespread than it ever was. And it's pretty awesome, because now it's like we have to prove to them that Quip is the answer. But there's widespread interest in new ways of working together that there weren't. So I wouldn't change the product we're working on, but I'd fix all the usability problems of the first version.
You know, nearly 4 years in, and you guys have, you know, accomplished so much, and you're nearly 40 people. But at the same time, because of the scope of the vision, it also seems that you're just beginning.
Yeah, I mean, we always use this term internally, and it's a little bit of a cliche, but we really think it's a marathon, not a race. To give you some context, like, Microsoft has a complete monopoly on this space. They have, it's a multi, tens of billions of dollars a year in revenue, and companies like Google Apps with Gmail are making some headway in small businesses and mid-market companies, but it's still sort of a single-player system. And we're not naive enough to think that, like, overnight people are going to be like, you know what, I'm going to abandon all those metaphors and use this great new living document product. We know it's going to take a while, and we're really comfortable with that, because we think the opportunity to change the way people work and the business opportunity are big and important enough, it's worth it. And so that's really the way we look at it, is like a multi-decade process, and we've kind of structured the company to recognize that.
You've worked, was it with Mark, with Larry, with Sergey, with some of the biggest entrepreneurs of our time. When you think of the term success, and whatever success means to you, very broadly, who comes to mind as, someone that's one of your biggest heroes, or someone you seek to emulate, whether it's personally or professionally, and why?
Yeah, so two people have been really, I should say three people who have been really influential in my life are actually the only three people I've ever worked for, surprisingly. So John Lilly, Marissa Meyer, and Mark Zuckerberg. And for me, they were in a position where they were sort of my mentors and literally my bosses through, my internships, Google, and then Facebook. And I'll just describe Mark Zuckerberg as my most recent one, and I don't want to spend too much time answering one question. But the thing I took away from Mark that I have not seen replicated in anyone else to this degree is this fierce independence. He had the ability to, he was really open. He always wanted criticism and advice about everything, but he would take all this advice, and if he would be willing to make the most unpopular decision if he thought it was the right thing to do. And it's really, as I said, it's hard to describe how hard that is in practice, because, you know, when you think about the context that this was Mark's first job after dropping out of college, and investors and more experienced managers are telling him to do this thing, and he decides to do it differently because he believes in his heart it's the right thing to do, and intellectually it's the right thing to do. That was amazing. And I saw that kind of boldness. And, you know, it was everything from, for example, like when Facebook launched Newsfeed, there was these protest groups because people thought it was a, like they really were unhappy with the change in the product experience. But Mark knew that that social discovery part of Facebook was actually going to be extremely important to what he wanted to build. And to actually manage the company through that, to say, yeah, it's unpopular, but we're going to do it anyway because it's the right thing to do, is extremely challenging. I mean, it's managing the morale inside the company. It's having the confidence in yourself that you're actually right. And I really try to like come close to having that level of boldness in my own life. And I don't think I do, though. I mean, it's really, I think he has it more than anyone I've ever met. What I love about John is his like relentless optimism. So like he was always interested in like new products and product design in a way that was extremely infectious. Like there were, I think, you know, it was in the dot-com bubble. So it was kind of similar to this time now where there's lots of tech companies and lots of products, and you'd be at coffee and you'd hear a lot of like jaded sarcasm, like, oh, look at that dumb company over there. They're never going to exist, or they got all that funding for something stupid, or whatever it was. There was a lot of cynicism just like around the office place. And every time I talked to John, it was the opposite. It was like, wow, that's actually pretty neat. Did you see how they did that there? Or did you see that cool product idea embedded in this? And I really thought that was like the best part of Silicon Valley. I mean, to be able to like sift through all the money and the jaded cynicism and actually see what was great, which is like people creating things. And I try to keep that perspective just because like, no matter how dumb one idea looks, if you actually dig a little deeper, there's always something really great in these products people are making. And I try to keep that optimistic perspective.
Go back in time and give advice to your 25-year-olds.
Oh, wow, that's tough. 25-year-old self, so in the middle of Google. You know, one thing that I think I've learned a lot about since Google, but I didn't know much about there, was learning more about like marketing and sort of branding. You know, it's interesting because at Google, it was very, very engineering driven. I mean, to an extreme that I think is pretty unprecedented. And the brand was essentially the lack of a brand. It was a logo on a homepage and this really utilitarian minimalist experience that produced this wonderful brand of simplicity and speed. But it wasn't simply sort of like consciously crafted or talked about. And I think it's been a little bit of a blind spot in my career since that I've gotten better at. But just because it was such a minimal part of Google, I think it's something I had to work a lot on since then.
What's something you used to sort of fervently believe that you now see as misguided in some way, whether it's, you know, in the last 4 years with Quip, or, you know, in the last decade, whether it relates to work, you know, hiring philosophy, culture, career strategy, or personal life?
Something, just because it's kind of topical, there's been a bunch of those things. Technology is very hard to predict. But I thought tablets and the iPad would be much more popular than they are in practice. So, you know, the iPad grew extremely quickly and then plateaued and now is like, by most people's metrics, kind of waning in popularity, relatively speaking. And I thought that the path of the tablet would have been that they would have gotten progressively more powerful and ended up sort of a convergence device.
On that thread, where are you, you know, overrated or underrated in terms of VR?
Wait, say that again?
Virtual reality, is it overrated or?
I think underrated. I actually think virtual reality is going to be one of the most impactful technologies over the next like 5 or 10 years. You know, in my mind, what's really cool about virtual reality is it's one of the first ways people can actually have experiences they wouldn't otherwise be able to have. And I think there's going to be a moment where there's a big event where people actually, via hopefully very inexpensive, you know, phone attachment or whatever, can actually experience an event, whether it's a natural disaster or the NBA finals or something like that, you know, the presidential inauguration, where they actually get to experience being there. And I think it'll instantly sort of, you know, project it into a mainstream experience. And I really hope that over time it becomes like a great way for people to develop empathy and actually sort of put themselves in other people's shoes. And I think there haven't been that many technologies that really achieve that, other than, you know, online video, but I still think it sort of pales in comparison to VR in terms of the kind of emotional experience.
Artificial intelligence.
I'm going to go with overrated, but I think in part just because it's so hyped right now. I think that right now, this is, I would qualify like a superficial understanding of some of the technologies, but from my understanding, there's been a lot of progress on like making the algorithms work better on really specialized hardware and at a much bigger scale than before, but there hasn't really been like a really true algorithmic breakthrough in a while. And I don't know if we're gonna like achieve this promise of like true unsupervised learning in a really general way in the short term. And then even when we do, I'm not sure there's like a true killer app just yet. I think intelligent agents and all that are really interesting, but I would love to be proven wrong. Like I'd love the killer app to like present itself, but like recommendation systems and intelligent agents and all that are like interesting, but I'm not sure if they're totally game changing as much as people make them out to be.
A little overblown or something.
Yeah, I think it's premature. It's actually something I personally am mildly concerned about, but I don't think it's going to happen in the time frame that sort of some of the more I'm trying to say paranoid people are making it out to be. Like I don't think the singularity is around the corner, just given the current state of technology. You know, even what we're calling unsupervised learning is still being done in very specific domains like image recognition. And well, I think the algorithms are really similar. I think there's a pretty big gap between that and true, you know, singularity level artificial intelligence.
How about Bitcoin?
Majorly overrated, in my opinion. Though I think I'm in the minority on this one. But at the end of the day, I think it like checks all the boxes for a lot of people who are sort of like techno-utopian. And, you know, it's like not controlled by government in a way of, you know, exchanging value in this sort of like verifiable, decentralized way. But at the end of the day, I think that especially with all the issues in the Bitcoin community right now, it's not necessarily like that much easier than a lot of the alternatives, despite the government regulation and centralized nature of them. There's still, it's not necessarily the easiest way to transfer value from one entity to another right now. And if it can't even be that, I don't see it sort of like true mainstream adoption.
From your answers, you know, certainly techno, what's the word? Techno optimistic, but not tech utopian.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I really think technologies reach mainstream when there's like a killer experience that justifies their existence to like someone who doesn't understand the technology. And so when I've been wrong, and as I said, I've been wrong a lot, it's that I couldn't imagine what that application is. But until just the technology for technology's sake things, often I think are really easy to hype in the technology community, but don't necessarily resonate for the mainstream. And the reason why I think virtual reality is an easier call to make for me is I think the immediate sort of emotional applications of the technology are immediately apparent, you know, and because I think the idea that you want to experience things, you know, that you can't be there physically as a mainstream appealing concept. Whereas for a lot of these sort of like infrastructural things, I think there's a higher bar to say, okay, well, why, what will this transform? What will this make an order of magnitude better to sort of justify all the hype around it? And I think it's very likely I'm wrong about a lot of these things. I just haven't seen that application quite yet.
What does Quip eventually become? You know, if Quip becomes the iconic company that you want it to become.
Yeah, so for me, the way it would play out is that it's the way every company gets work done. It's the first thing you install on your phone and your laptop when you become an employee. It's the first thing you open in the morning and the first thing you close at night. And I mean, the last thing you close at night. And I think that what that means is it's this central tool that everybody at every company uses every day. And I think that's what we really like, is that kind of universal application. We're not making marketing software. We're not making engineering software. We're making like the tool that everyone uses to communicate and collaborate. And so that's kind of my litmus test. You walk into any office in the world and it's open on the screen. And I hope to achieve that one day.
It's you've achieved it in our office. To be
step
sure.
One. Step one is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. Step two, everyone who watches this, you know,
go to
yeah, which is perfect. Okay, Brett, this has been fantastic. Thank you for coming on. Any last minute plugs for where people can, you know, find Quip online?
Go to quip.com, and I really appreciate everyone who took the time to watch this. It was really fun, and it was an awesome experience.
Thanks, Brett. We're a huge fan, and we'll talk soon.
Talk to you soon.